Tots me we, everyone. It's good to be here. Welcome. It's really an honor to be invited to share what we've been up to in Indigenous traditional ecological and cultural knowledge with our students and community and partners in the region. And so we're really looking forward in our always too brief time to share a little bit about what's going on and our ITEC certificate and what Indigenous folks have been doing to reclaim our health, heal the land, heal the people. So thank you for being here. So we're really excited to be presenting on the role of Indigenous traditional ecological and cultural knowledge in decolonizing academia and nurturing our healthy futures through our first foods and plant relatives. And this is a fresh photo of our Indigenous leaders for sustainable futures and our tribal internship class, and also our first foods and the Pacific Northwest class. We were out at the Bureau of Environmental Services partnership site in Shokake Wetlands. And that's about a 5-acre site in the Columbia Slough in the Portland metro region. And we are in the process of building a living willow dome gathered and tended from this site we've been at for about 7 years. And we'll talk more in our time together about some of the projects we're doing with partners and as part of our curriculum, but also as part of re-engaging and bringing community and our practices into these sites. So I think it's always important when we talk about decolonizing academia, we have to recognize how we got here. And so a lot of our programming is foundational in describing and understanding what the doctrine of discovery is. We're not going to go into all of that today. But over the years, my experience has been is that the excitement and thrill of re-engaging on the land and doing a project or restoration work or finding out what the gifts of our plant relatives are for food or for healing or for medicine making, folks can skip over the history of land and histories of genocide and manifest destiny and the doctrine of discovery, which have been key in not just removing Indigenous people from our traditional homelands, but also disrupting so many of our cultural practices in an effort to take land and make it into something else. And so when we look at the doctrine of discovery, as simple as recognizing in 1493 that when the Pope issued the announcement to everyone that if land was occupied by non-Christians, then they had no title to the land. And that began the story, and it continues today, of how Indigenous people globally have been marginalized and removed. As the papal bull explains, we have no more standing than a deer or a squirrel or a tree. And in some ways, part of what our ITEC work is recognizing that to be standing with our trees and our salmon and our deer is a very powerful and connective relationship. And so how do we advocate on behalf of reclaiming this place we all call home for all of our relatives? And so the doctrine of discovery is something we're always trying to educate partners and governments about how we got here and what has to be done. We can follow through removal of ceded lands, tribal sovereignty, which we'll be sharing some of that information for tribal food sovereignty, but it's really across all land practice. Treaties and federal recognition, relocation, termination, restoration, and in the process now of reclamation, resurgence, and regeneration. Really dynamic time. But to understand all of those terms and to understand what has happened to people and place is critical to understanding reclamation, resurgence, and regeneration that's going on. So for Indigenous traditional ecological and cultural knowledge, impacts on protecting the health of all of our relatives. We were presenting at U of W quite a few years ago on these themes. And we recognize the role of Indigenous ways of knowing and the traditional land practices to inform and guide current land practices. It also represents new partnerships in education and land reclamation using an Indigenous cultural practice and holistic sustainability model. We'll look at sustainability as well. We recognize that it's the seventh generation, whether we're using the term sustainability, and there are many great Indigenous voices that are defining and redefining what is cultural sustainability, what does sustainability mean in our Indigenous leadership for sustainable futures. We take a look at that, we dismantle some of that, and then we reclaim it as understanding, living, thinking, planning for the future generations, the seventh generation. And so these serve as gathering places where our plant relatives can be cultivated and cultural traditions can be practiced. We recognize too, utilizing Indigenous traditional knowledge to restore land on behalf of our plant relatives to deepen our understanding of knowledge and engagement through our seasonal rounds, our seasonal tending, harvests, and educational workshops, which is part of in that first slide, what we're up to and what we're weaving into everything we do on campus and throughout the community. And it demonstrates a broader capacity building implications of Indigenous ITEC on long-term land restoration and management. It serves as a basis for expanding this social cultural practice throughout the region and beyond. We're connecting internationally, and we'll share just a little bit about that too. Guiding values have come out of quite a few decades of being in our Indigenous community K through 12 before I arrived into higher ed, or whatever we're calling that, academia. I'm not sure it's higher, but it's academia. And part of what we do is we're always redefining and looking at the terminology that is out there and how do we break that up and recognize a non-hierarchical system. And so when we look at our guiding values, they're enduring. They have not changed. These have come over the many years, whether it was with our Native Montessori program, with Portland Public Schools, Title VII, Title IX, Title VI now, Indian education programs. But we can see remembering our responsibility to the seventh generation and remembering our responsibility to the land, recognizing the role of the sacred. All land is sacred. Reciprocity and interdependence, respecting cultural protocols, cultivating healthy relationships. We are all related. Living, planning, designing, managing for the seventh generation. And these continue to guide the work. There are more, but these have taken up an enduring role in the development of ITEC and what we're doing and working with our communities today. When we look at Indigenous land, local, state, and federal governments have a lot of that in their portfolios, and we recognize that in shifting that narrative to educate them, but to reclaim and to get back on the land and to start tending our plant relatives, but also to be with the water, bring our prayers back, scatter the seeds, get our children out there digging camas. We are creating the relationships and shifting again that narrative, creating new positions, new staffing that are centered in Indigenous guidance, Indigenous community outreach, but also Indigenous science and Indigenous visioning. So we're working with all of these, and certainly conservation and environmental organizations, and creating an awareness. And they're often the groups that really benefit from that other slide about how did we get here? What is manifest destiny? What is the doctrine of discovery? What happened? What does termination mean? It means just that, termination, which impacted tribes in the Northwest severely. And so we want to make sure they have an understanding, a profound capacity of understanding that the land that they're on has a story, and they will have to know that story to move forward, and they're not going to do it without Indigenous people. So those are some of the challenges over the the last few decades that we continue to address and we continue to move forward with.
I'm going to talk a little bit about tribal food sovereignty, which is the world that I am lucky enough to get to work in. And I'm also working through a cold, so if I have to pause and cough, my apologies. So when I graduated from undergrad, I started a full-time job with my tribe in our culture department and had previously interned with them for many years while in undergrad and did a lot of work with camas and huckleberry and smelt and wapato and was working with all of these traditional foods, not realizing what all of that could mean or would look like in the future. And then I was asked by a colleague from our garden program to present with her on a food sovereignty panel. And I said, no, probably not. And she was like, what do you mean, Emma? And I'm like, I don't think that I would have enough to say about that. And she's like, you do food sovereignty work all of the time. But it was the first time I had ever heard that term. And so she explained it to me and I was like, oh, wow, that's really cool. There's a term for all of this work. And so food sovereignty is really diverse. It looks different for every person. It looks different for every community. But the National Congress of American Indians has this breakdown, which I think is helpful for folks that are just learning about food sovereignty. And that says freely develop and implement self-determined definitions of food sovereignty. And that's like the biggest takeaway here is that us as Indigenous communities, BIPOC communities, get to determine what our communities need, like for having that control back over their own food systems, for getting access to land, for knowing how their food is being tended, for having access to culturally appropriate foods, many things embedded in food sovereignty. And it really means like getting that control back to your local community and understanding how those foods are impacting your health. And so folks oftentimes will then ask, well, what's a tribal food sovereignty framework? And it's kind of the same answer. It looks different for everybody. But one of the important things here is that it does not only involve first foods. And so a lot of folks unfamiliar with Indigenous communities doing this kind of work will generally assume that it only involves our first foods, and our first foods are an extremely important part of it and very instrumental to this work, but it's also us having community wellness gardens and having like raised beds built in tribal members' backyards, things like that, because it's really just us having access and control over cultivating and caring for our own foods. And the general goals generally are to support community health and connection to your foodways. And a really big talk in the tribal food sovereignty world is this saying that's found within the Indigenous Food Sovereignty in the United States book, which I recommend if you're interested. And they say that you can't be sovereign if you can't feed your own people. And so a lot of us tribal nations in the US that were lucky enough to be afforded tribal recognition, which also has many layers, are considered sovereign nations. But are we really sovereign if we can't feed our own people? And feeding your own people requires a lot. Like, can you manage your own buffalo herds? Can you have your own meat processing factory? Do you have enough tribal members interested in doing this work? Do you have enough community support from your tribal council? Do you have access to the lands? Are they safe? Are they contaminated? There's so many questions that we have to ask ourselves before we engage with different parts of the landscape because of safety conditions, but also just what it means to be an honorable harvester and engaging in the landscape in a respectful way to make sure that our plant relatives are receiving what they need from us as we take from them, which is generally not something folks think about. And so more camas, because obviously Judy and I love camas. And so what is a really big part of tribal food sovereignty is this world of seasonal rounds. And I think it is what it sounds like. Pre-contact Indigenous folks were able to follow their foods throughout the seasons. And so they were really well-versed in understanding the cues of the seasons. And so they would know that when this specific tree was changing or this weather pattern or these waters were rising or the snow was melting off the mountains, like all of these cues were able to tell them, oh, it's about time to go to the Camas prairies. It's about time to go to the Huckleberry Meadows. Maybe the lamprey are coming in. It's going to be another run for the salmon. And so they really had to be aware of all of these plant relatives, giving them cues so that they could know where to go next for their food sources. And they had it down to a science. And then obviously that was all interrupted and also illegalized and everything else. And so before that happened, though, because it was so seasonal, a lot of the times families and communities would go back to the same areas they were years and years and years before. So they could store certain things to make traveling easier. And sometimes they'd be there for weeks at a time, sometimes months. It really depended upon what they were gathering and when the season was. And so one thing that Judy and I always like to connect folks with is this understanding of a cultural ecosystem. And it's a really big part of IPEC. And cultural ecosystems, I'm sure many of you have never heard of, and that's perfectly understandable and predictable, unfortunately. But cultural ecosystems are ecosystems that actually require human interaction to thrive and survive. And in our Western world, we're oftentimes taught that us humans only cause harm, and that if we want to conserve an area, you can like fix it, but then never touch it again because you're only going to cause more harm. And so these cultural ecosystems actually teach us differently. And they range from things like Mountain Huckleberry Meadows, Camas Prairies, the urban landscape that we're all probably in right now, and wetlands. And so what that means is that things like the Camas Prairie, they need us to do cultural burns. They need us to remove competitive species like coniferous trees. They need us to come in and harvest because that harvesting actually aerates their soil and they really appreciate that aeration. And so those very intentional tending practices promote their health and they need that. And that was removed when we were no longer able to do those things. And we still in many forms cannot, but many tribes in the region now do have access to like slivers of things like Camas Prairies, and they're very intentionally starting that reciprocal relationship with the land again, which is showing folks that, oh yeah, like that makes sense. I can see the difference of tending here versus not being able to engage with the land in that meaningful way. And so this obviously works against the Western standard of calling humans separate from the land because it shows us that we are not separate from the land. We are very much a part of it. And the reason why that threatens our Western system is because they really like to objectify Mother Earth and everything she provides us. And when folks start building these relationships and advocating and caring for the lands, it causes problems for industries that gain wealth from extracting, right? But we really need to do this work. We need folks to create these relationships and understand that their garden is a cultural ecosystem and that they can create things like a microprairie in their backyard or the community garden and introduce native plants that maybe haven't been found in that landscape for generations. And that's how you reclaim the space.